Ursula K. Le Guin. Ursula K. Le Guin, 1929 to present, www.ursulakleguin.com, lives in Eugene, Oregon. She is a writer whose literary impact extends far beyond the boundaries of the science fiction field since her advent in the 1960s. One of the reigning masters of science fiction, winner of many Hugo and Nebula Awards, she is the author of The Left Hand of Darkness, 1969, The Dispossessed, 1974, and many other innovative science fiction novels and stories, as well as the modern classic of fantasy, the Earthsea Trilogy, and a number of provocative essays on SF and fantasy. Her most recent books are the SF Story Collection, The Birthday of the World, 2002, Changing Planes, 2003, A Collection of Fiction, The Wave in the Mind, 2004, Criticism, and Gifts, 2004, a novel. A fantasist, a feminist, a literate and humane writer of poetry and fiction, Le Guin has often been portrayed as having left science fiction for greener pastures, although it has always been only one of her major modes. Le Guin's influence on science fiction over recent decades has been evident in the movement toward deeper and richer characterization. She is not referred to as a space opera writer, although this story is clearly set in the far future in space, and we bring this example into the discourse on space opera because we think its importation of anthropological ideas is causing pressure on some of the most ambitious writers of space opera to abandon or modify the military and hierarchical modes. The Showbiz story describes a society in which a consensus matters more than individual viewpoints. As the narrator puts it, a chain of command is easy to describe. A network of response isn't. To those who live by mutual empowerment, thick description, complex and open-ended, is normal and comprehensible, but to those whose only model is hierarchic control, such description seems a muddle, a mess, along with what it describes. Who's in charge here? Get rid of all these petty details. How many cooks spoil a soup? Let's get this perfectly clear now. Take me to your leader. The term thick description was conceived by the anthropologist Clifford Geertz, whose 1973 book, The Interpretation of Culture, ends with a long, rich, riveting account of Balinese cockfighting. Because that sample is so well written, some detractors have suggested that the only true practitioner of thick description is Geertz himself. In a nutshell, Geertz proposes that meaning emerges from the total social context. Thus, many of the details heretofore discarded by scientists as irrelevant should be included in ethnographic observations. To illustrate this claim, Geertz catalogues the possible meanings of a person closing and opening one eye. He could have an involuntary twitch. He could be winking. He could be parodying someone winking. Le Guin uses the example of not breathing. I can't breathe, one said. I am not breathing, one said. There is nothing to breathe, one said. You are breathing. Please breathe, said another. The Showbiz story posits a reality that emerges as the sum of what all the participants say, a meta-narrative, a democratically constructed myth. Le Guin tells us that the observer is part of the reality she's trying to describe. Every observer sees things differently, and the melding of those interpretations becomes the world. Whether the Le Guin influence we begin to discern in such ambitious space opera writers as John Clute, Appleseed and M. John Harrison is real and will spread remains to be seen. The Showbiz Story, Ursula K. Le Guin. They met at V-Port more than a month before their first flight together, and there, calling themselves after their ship, as most crews did, became the Showbiz. Their first consensual decision was to spend their IZI in the coastal village of Leiden on Hain, where the negative ions could do their thing. Leiden was a fishing port with an 80,000-year history and a population of 400. Its fisher folk farmed the rich shoal waters of their bay, shipped the catch inland to the cities, and managed the Leiden resort for vacationers and tourists and used space crews on IZI. The word is Hainish and means making a beginning together, or beginning to be together, or used technically, the period of time and area of space in which a group forms if it is going to form. A honeymoon is an IZI of two. The fisherwomen and fishermen of Leiden were as weathered as driftwood and about as talkative. Six-year-old Aston, who had misunderstood slightly, asked one of them if they were all 80,000 years old. "Nope," she said. Like most crews, the Showbiz used Hainish as their common language, so the name of the one Hainish crew member, Sweet Today, carried its meaning as words as well as name, and at first seemed a silly thing to call a big, tall, heavy woman in her late 50s, imposing of carriage and almost as taciturn as the villagers, but her reserve proved to be a deep well of congeniality and tact, to be called upon as needed, and her name soon began to sound quite right. She had family. All Hainish have family, kinfolk of all denominations, grandchildren and cross-cousins, of fines and cosines scattered all over the ecumen, but no relatives in this crew. She asked to be grandmother to Rig, Aston, and Betten, and was accepted. The only Shoby older than Sweet Today was the Terran Liddy, who was 72 EYs and not interested in grandmothering. Liddy had been navigating for 50 years, and there was nothing she didn't know about Nafal ships, although occasionally she forgot that their ship was the Shoby and called it the So-So or the Altera, and there were things she didn't know, none of them knew, about the Shoby. They talked, as human beings do, about what they didn't know. Churton theory was the main topic of conversation, evenings at the driftwood fire on the beach after dinner. The adults had read whatever there was to read about it, of course, before they ever volunteered for the test mission. Gaviter had more recent information and presumably a better understanding of it than the others, but it had to be pried out of him. Only 25, the only Cetian in the crew, much hairier than the others, and not gifted in language, he spent a lot of time on the defensive, assuming that as an arresti, he was more proficient at mutual aid and more adept at cooperation than the others, he lectured them about their propertarian habits. But he held tight to his knowledge because he needed the advantage it gave him. For a while, he would speak only in negatives. Don't call it the Churton drive. It isn't a drive. Don't call it the Churton effect. It isn't an effect. What is it then? A long lecture ensued, beginning with the rebirth of Cetian physics since the revision of Shevikian temporalism by the intervalists, and ending with the general conceptual framework of the Churton. Everyone listened very carefully, and finally Sweet Today spoke carefully. "So the ship will be moved," she said. "By ideas?" "No, no, no, no," said Gaviter, but he hesitated for the next word so long that Karth asked a question. Well, you haven't actually talked about any physical, material events or effects at all. The question was characteristically indirect. Carth and Orith, the Gathenians, who, with their two children, were the affective focus of the crew, the hearth of it, in their terms, came from a not very theoretically minded subculture and knew it. Gavitr could run rings round them with his Cetean physico-philosophico-techno-natter. He did so at once. His accent did not make his explanations any clearer. He went on about coherence and meta-intervals, and at last demanded, with gestures of despair, "How can I say it in Kanish? No, it is not physical. It is not not physical. These are the categories our minds must discard entirely. This is the cold point." "Buff, buff, 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 buff," went Aston softly, passing behind the half-circle of adults at the driftwood fire on the wide twilit beach. Rig followed, also going buff, 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 but louder. They were being spaceships, to judge from their maneuvers around a dune and their communications. "Locked in orbit, navigator." But the noise they were imitating was the noise of the little fishing boats of Leiden putt-putting out to sea. "I crashed," Rig shouted, flailing in the sand. "Help, help, I crashed." "Hold on, ship two," Aston cried. "I'll rescue you. Don't breathe. Oh, trouble with the Churton drive. Buff, buff, ack, ack, brum, ack, 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 rum. Buff, 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 buff." They were 6 and 4 EYs old. Ty's son, Betten, who was 11, sat at the driftwood fire with the adults, though at the moment he was watching Rig and Aston, as if he wouldn't mind taking off to help rescue Ship Two. The little Gathenians had spent more time on ships than on planet, and Aston liked to boast about being actually 58. But this was Betten's first crew, and his only Nafal flight had been from Terra to Hain. He and his bio-mother, Ty, had lived in a reclamation commune on Terra. When she had drawn the lot for ecumenical service and requested training for ship duty, he had asked her to bring him as family. She had agreed, but after training, when she volunteered for this test flight, she had tried to get Betten to withdraw, to stay in training or go home. He had refused. Shan, who had trained with them, told the others this because the tension between the mother and son had to be understood to be used effectively in group formation. Betten had requested to come, and Ty had given in, but plainly not with an undivided will. Her relationship to the boy was cool and mannered. Shan offered him fatherly, brotherly warmth, but Betten accepted it sparingly, coolly, and sought no formal crew relation with him or anyone. Ship two was being rescued, and attention returned to the discussion. "All right," said Liddy. "We know that anything that goes faster than light, anything that goes faster than light, by so doing transcends the material slash immaterial category. That's how we got the Ansible, by distinguishing the message from the medium. But if we, the crew, are going to travel as messages, I want to understand how." Gavitr tore his hair. There was plenty to tear. It grew fine and thick, a mane on his head, a pelt on his limbs and body, a silvery nimbus on his hands and face. The fuzz on his feet was, at the moment, full of sand. "Cow," he cried. "I'm trying to tell you cow. Message? Information? No, that's old. That's Ansible technology. This is transilience. because the field is to be conceived as the virtual field in which the unreal interval becomes virtually effective through the mediary coherence. Don't you see? No, Liddy said. What do you mean by mediary? After several more bonfires on the beach, the consensus opinion was that Churton theory was accessible only to minds very highly trained in Seatian temporal physics. There was a less freely voiced conviction that the engineers who had built the Shobey's Churton apparatus did not entirely understand how it worked, or, more precisely, what it did when it worked. That it worked was certain. The Shobey was the fourth ship it had been tested with, using robot crew. So far, 62 instantaneous trips, or transiliences, had been effected between points from 400 kilometers to 27 light-years apart, with stopovers of varying lengths. Gaviter and Liddy steadfastly maintained that this proved that the engineers knew perfectly well what they were doing, and that for the rest of them, the seeming difficulty of the theory was only the difficulty human minds had in grasping a genuinely new concept. Like the circulation of the blood, said Ty. People went around with their hearts beating for a long time before they understood why. She did not look satisfied with her own analogy, and when Shan said, "The heart has its reasons, which reason does not know," she looked offended. "Mysticism," she said, in the tone of voice of one warning a companion about dog shit on the path. "Surely there's nothing beyond understanding in this process," Orith said, somewhat tentatively. "Nothing that can't be understood and reproduced." "And quantified," Gaviter said stoutly. "But even if people understand the process, nobody knows the human response to it, the experience of it, right? So we are to report on that. Why shouldn't it be just like the Nafal flight, only even faster?" Betton asked. "Because it is totally different," said Gaviter. "What could happen to us?" Some of the adults had discussed possibilities. All of them had considered them. Karth and Orith had talked it over in appropriate terms with their children, but evidently Betton had not been included in such discussions. "We don't know," Ty said sharply. "I told you that at the start, Betton." "Most likely it will be like Nafal flight," said Shan. "But the first people who flew Nafal didn't know what it would be like and had to find out the physical and psychic effects." "The worst thing," said Sweet today in her slow, comfortable voice, "would be that we would die. Other living things have been on some of the test flights. Crickets, and intelligent ritual animals on the last two Shobey tests. They were all right." It was a very long statement for Sweet today, and carried proportional weight. "We are almost certain," said Gaviter, "that no temporal rearrangement is involved in Churton, as it is in Nafal. And mass is involved only in terms of needing a certain core mass, just as for Ansible transmission, but not in itself. So maybe even a pregnant person could be a transilient." "They can't go on ships," Aston said. "The unborn dies if they do." Aston was half lying across Orith's lap. Rig, thumb in mouth, was asleep on Karth's lap. "When we were Oneblins," Aston went on, sitting up, "there were ritual animals with our crew, some fish and some Terran cats and a whole lot of Hainish ghouls. We got to play with them, and we helped thank the ghoul that they tested for lithovirus, but it didn't die. It bit Shoppy. The cats slept with us, but one of them went into Kemmer and got pregnant, and then the one Blin had to go to Hain, and she had to have an abortion, or all her unborns would have died inside her and killed her, too. Nobody knew a ritual for her to explain to her, but I fed her some extra food, and Rig cried. Other people I know cried, too, Karth said, stroking the child's hair. You tell good stories, Aston, Sweet Today observed. So we're sort of ritual humans, said Betten. Volunteers, Ty said. Experimenters, said Liddy. Experiencers, said Sean. Explorers, Orith said. Gamblers, said Karth. The boy looked from one face to the next. You know, Sean said, back in the time of the League, early in Nafal flight, they were sending out ships to really distant systems, trying to explore everything, crews that wouldn't come back for centuries. Maybe some of them are still out there, but some of them came back after 400, 500, 600 years, and they were all mad, crazy. He paused dramatically. But they were all crazy when they started. Unstable people. They had to be crazy to volunteer for a time dilation like that. What a way to pick a crew, eh? He laughed. Are we stable? Said Orith. I like instability. I like this job. I like the risk, taking the risk together. High stakes. That's the edge of it. The sweetness of it. Karth looked down at their children and smiled. Yes, together, Gavitr said. You aren't crazy. You are good. I love you. We are Amari. Amar, the others said to him, confirming this unexpected declaration. The young man scowled with pleasure, jumped up, and pulled off his shirt. I want to swim. Come on, Betten. Come on swimming, he said, and ran off towards the dark, vast waters that moved softly beyond the ruddy haze of their fire. The boy hesitated, then shed his shirt and sandals and followed. Sean pulled up Ty, and they followed. And finally the two old women went off into the night and the breakers, rolling up their pants legs, laughing at themselves. To Gathenians, even on a warm summer night, on a warm summer world, the sea is no friend. The fire is where you stay. Orith and Aston moved closer to Karth and watched the flames, listening to the faint voices out in the glimmering surf, now and then talking quietly in their own tongue, while the little sister-brother slept on. After 30 lazy days at Leiden, the Shobies caught the fish train inland to the city, where a Fleetlander picked them up at the train station and took them to the spaceport on V, the next planet out from Hain. They were rested, tanned, bonded, and ready to go. One of Sweet Today's hemi-affiliate cousins, once removed, was on Ansible duty in V-port. She urged the Shobies to ask the inventors of the Churton on Urus and Anaris any questions they had about Churton operation. The purpose of the experimental flight is understanding, she insisted, and your full intellectual participation is essential. They've been very anxious about that. Liddy snorted. Now for the ritual, said Sean, as they went to the Ansible room in the Sunward bubble. They'll explain to the animals what they're going to do and why, and ask them to help. The animals don't understand that, Betten said in his cold, angelic treble. It's just to make the humans feel better. The humans understand? Sweet Today asked. We all use each other, Orith said. The ritual says we have no right to do so. Therefore, we accept the responsibility for the suffering we cause. Betten listened and brooded. Gvetr addressed the Ansible first and talked to it for half an hour, mostly in Pravik and mathematics. Finally, apologizing and looking a little unnerved, he invited the others to use the instrument. There was a pause. Liddy activated it, introduced herself, and said, "We have agreed that none of us, except Gvetr, has the theoretical background to grasp the principles of the Churton." A scientist, 22 light-years away, responded in Hainish via the rather flat auto-translator voice, but with unmistakable hopefulness, "The Churton in lay terms may be seen as displacing the virtual field in order to realize relational coherence in terms of the transcendental experientiality." "Quite," said Liddy. "As you know, the material effects have been nil, and negative effect on low-intelligence sentience also nil. But there is considered to be a possibility that the participation of high intelligence in the process might affect the displacement in one way or another, and that such displacement would reciprocally affect the participant. What has the level of our intelligence got to do with how the Churton functions?" Ty asked. A pause. Their interlocutor was trying to find the words to accept the responsibility. "We have been using intelligence as shorthand for the psychic complexity and cultural dependence of our species," said the translator voice at last. "The presence of the transilient as conscious mind, non-during transilience, is the untested factor. But if the process is instantaneous, how can we be conscious of it?" Oris asked. "Precisely," said the Ansible, and after another pause, continued, "As the experimenter is an element of the experiment, so we assume that the transilient may be an element or agent of transilience. This is why we asked for a crew to test the process, rather than one or two volunteers. The psychic interbalance of a bonded social group is a margin of strength against disintegrative or incomprehensible experience, if any such occurs. Also, the separate observations of the group members will mutually interverify." "Who programs this translator?" Sean snarled in a whisper. "Interverify. Shit." Liddy looked around at the others, inviting questions. "How long will the trip actually take?" Betton asked. "No long," the translator voice said, then self-corrected. "No time." Another pause. "Thank you," said Sweet Today, and the scientist on a planet 22 years of time-dilated travel from V-Port answered, "We are grateful for your generous courage, and our hope is with you." They went directly from the Ansible room to the Shobi. The Churton equipment, which was not very space-consuming, and the controls of which consisted essentially of an on-off switch, had been installed alongside the nearly-as-fast-as-light motivators and controls of an ordinary interstellar ship of the ecumenical fleet. The Shobi had been built on Hain about 400 years ago and was 32 years old. Most of its early runs had been exploratory with a Hainish Chifilwarian crew. Since, in such runs, a ship might spend years in orbit in a planetary system, the Hainish and Chifilwarians, feeling that it might as well be lived in rather than endured, had arranged and furnished it like a very large, very comfortable house. Three of its residential modules had been disconnected and left in the hangars on V, and still there was more than enough room for a crew of only 10. Ty, Betton, and Sean, new from Terra, and Gvetr from Anaris, accustomed to the barracks and the communal austerities of their marginally habitable worlds, stalked about the Shobi, disapproving it. "Excremental," Gvetr growled. "Luxury," Ty sneered. Sweet today, Liddy and the Gathenians, more used to the amenities of shipboard life, settled right in and made themselves at home, and Gaviter and the younger Terrans found it hard to maintain ethical discomfort in the spacious, high-ceilinged, well-furnished, slightly shabby living rooms and bedrooms, studies, high- and low-G gyms, the dining room, library, kitchen, and bridge of the Shobi. The carpet in the bridge was a genuine Hinyakolil, soft, deep blues and purples woven in the patterns of the constellations of the Hainish sky. There was a large, healthy plantation of Terran bamboo in the meditation gym, part of the ship's self-contained vegetal-slash-respiratory system. The windows of any room could be programmed by the homesick to a view of Abanay or New Cairo or the beach at Leiden, or cleared to look out on the suns nearer and farther and the darkness between the suns. Rig and Aston discovered that as well as the elevators, there was a stately staircase with a curving banister, leading from the reception hall up to the library. They slid down the banister, shrieking wildly, until Sean threatened to apply a local gravity field and force them to slide up it, which they besought him to do. Betten watched the little ones with a superior gaze and took the elevator. But the next day, he slid down the banister, going a good deal faster than Rig and Aston, because he could push off harder and had greater mass, and nearly broke his tailbone. It was Betten who organized the tray-sliding races, but Rig generally won them, being small enough to stay on the tray all the way down the stairs. None of the children had had any lessons at the beach, except in swimming and being showbies. But while they waited through an unexpected 5-day delay at V-Port, Gaviter did physics with Betten and math with all three daily in the library, and they did some history with Sean and Orith and danced with Ty in the low-G gym. When she danced, Ty became light, free, laughing. Rig and Aston loved her then, and her son danced with her like a colt, like a kid, awkward and blissful. Sean often joined them. He was a dark and elegant dancer, and she would dance with him, but even then was shy, would not touch. She had been celibate since Betten's birth. She did not want Sean's patient, urgent desire, did not want to cope with it, with him. She would turn from him to Betten, and son and mother would dance, wholly absorbed in the steps, the airy pattern they made together. Watching them, the afternoon before the test flight, Sweet Today began to wipe tears from her eyes, smiling, never saying a word. "Life is good," said Gaviter very seriously to Liddy. "It'll do," she said. Orith, who was just coming out of female Kemmer, having thus triggered Karth's male Kemmer, all of which, by coming on unexpectedly early, had delayed the test flight for these past 5 days. Enjoyable days for all. Orith watched Rig, whom she had fathered, dance with Aston, whom she had borne, and watched Karth watch them, and said in Karhidish, "Tomorrow." The edge was very sweet. Anthropologists solemnly agree that we must not attribute cultural constants to the human population of any planet, but certain cultural traits or expectations do seem to run deep. Before dinner that last night in port, Sean and Ty appeared in black and silver uniforms of the Terran Ecumen, which had cost them, Terra also still had a money economy, a half-year's allowance. Aston and Rig clamored at once for equal grandeur. Karth and Orith suggested their party clothes, and Sweet Today brought out silver lace scarves, but Aston sulked and Rig imitated. The idea of a uniform, Aston told them, was that it was the same. Why? Oris inquired. Old Liddy answered sharply, so that no one is responsible. She then went off and changed into a black velvet evening suit that wasn't a uniform, but that didn't leave Ty and Sean sticking out like sore thumbs. She had left Terra at age 18 and never been back nor wanted to, but Ty and Sean were shipmates. Karth and Orith got the idea and put on their finest fur-trimmed heaps, and the children were appeased with their own party clothes, plus all of Karth's hereditary and massive gold jewelry. Sweet Today appeared in a pure white robe, which she claimed was in fact ultraviolet. Kaviter braided his mane. Betten had no uniform, but needed none, sitting beside his mother at table in a visible glory of pride. Meals, sent up from the port kitchens, were very good, and this one was superb, a delicate Hainish Ianwi, with all seven sauces, followed by a pudding flavored with Terran chocolate. A lively evening ended quietly at the big fireplace in the library. The logs were fake, of course, but good fakes. No use having a fireplace on a ship and then burning plastic in it. The neocellulose logs and kindling smelled right, resisted catching, caught with spits and sparks and smoke billows, flared up bright. Orith had laid the fire. Karth lit it. Everybody gathered round. "Tell bedtime stories," Rig said. Orith told about the ice caves of Kern Land, how a ship sailed into the great blue sea cave and disappeared, and was never found by the boats that entered the caves in search. But 70 years later, that ship was found drifting, not a living soul aboard, nor any sign of what had become of them, off the coast of Osamyet, 1,000 miles overland from Kerm. Another story? Liddy told about the little desert wolf who lost his wife and went to the land of the dead for her and found her there dancing with the dead and nearly brought her back to the land of the living but spoiled it by trying to touch her before they got all the way back to life. And she vanished, and he could never find the way back to the place where the dead danced, no matter how he looked and howled and cried. Another story. Sean told about the boy who sprouted a feather every time he told a lie, until his commune had to use him for a duster. Another. Gaviter told about the winged people called Gluns, who were so stupid that they died out because they kept hitting each other head-on in mid-air. They weren't real, he added conscientiously, only a story. Another. No. Bedtime now. Rig and Aston went round as usual for a good night hug, and this time Betten followed them. When he came to Ty, he did not stop, for she did not like to be touched, but she put out her hand, drew the child to her, and kissed his cheek. He fled in joy. Stories, said Sweet Today. Ours begins tomorrow, eh? A chain of command is easy to describe. A network of response isn't. To those who live by mutual empowerment, thick description, complex and open-ended, is normal and comprehensible. But to those whose only model is hierarchic control, such description seems a muddle, a mess, along with what it describes. Who's in charge here? Get rid of all these petty details. How many cooks spoil a soup? Let's get this perfectly clear now. Take me to your leader. The old navigator was at the Nafal console, of course, and Gaviter at the paltry Churton console. Orith was wired into the AI. Ty, Sean, and Karth were their respective support, and what Sweet Today did might be called supervising or overseeing, if that didn't suggest a hierarchic function. interseeing, maybe, or subvising. Rig and Aston, always naffled, to use Rig's word, in the ship's library, where, during the boring and disorienting experience of travel at near light speed, Aston could try to look at pictures or listen to a music tape, and Rig could curl up on and under a certain furry blanket and go to sleep. Benton's crew function during flight was Elder Sib. He stayed with the little ones, provided himself with a barf bag, since he was one of those whom Nuffall flight made queasy, and focused the intervid on Liddy and Gaviter so he could watch what they did. So they all knew what they were doing, as regards Nuffall flight. As regards the Churton process, they knew that it was supposed to effectuate their transilience to a solar system 17 light-years from V-port without temporal interval. But nobody anywhere knew what they were doing. So Liddy looked around, like the violinist who raises her bow to poise the chamber group for the first chord, a flicker of eye contact, and sent the Shobi into Nuffall mode, as Gaviter, like the cellist whose bow comes down in that same instant to ground the chord, sent the Shobi into Churton mode. They entered Unduration. They Churtoned. No long, as the Ansible had said. "What's wrong?" Sean whispered. "By damn," said Gaviter. "What?" said Liddy, blinking and shaking her head. "That's it," Ty said, flicking readouts. "That's not A-60, what's it?" Liddy said, still blinking. Sweet Today was gestalting them, all 10 at once, the 7 on the bridge, and by intervid the 3 in the library. Benton had cleared a window, and the children were looking out at the murky, brownish convexity that filled half of it. Rig was holding a dirty, furry blanket. Karth was taking the electrodes off Orith's temples, disengaging the AI link. "There was no interval," Orith said. "We aren't anywhere," Liddy said. "There was no interval," Gaviter repeated, scowling at the console. "That's right." "Nothing happened," Karth said, skimming through the AI flight report. Orith got up, went to the window, and stood motionless looking out. "That's it. M60-340 Nolo," Ty said. All their words fell dead, had a false sound. "Well, we did it, Shobies," said Sean. Nobody answered. "Buzz V-port on the Ansible," Sean said with determined jollity. "Tell 'em we're all here in one piece." "All where?" Orith asked. "Yes, of course," Sweet Today said, but did nothing. "Right," said Ty, going to the ship's Ansible. She opened the field, centered to V, and sent a signal. Ship's Ansibles worked only in the visual mode. She waited, watching the screen. She re-signaled. They were all watching the screen. "Nothing going through," she said. Nobody told her to check the centering coordinates. In a network system, nobody gets to dump their anxieties that easily. She checked the coordinates. She signaled, rechecked, reset, resignaled, opened the field and centered to Abene on Anaris and signaled. The Ansible screen was blank. "Check the," Sean said and stopped himself. "The Ansible is not functioning," Ty reported formally to her crew. "Do you find malfunction?" Sweet Today asked. "No, non-function." "We're going back now," said Liddy, still seated at the Nuffall console. Her words, her tone, shook them apart. "No, we're not," Benton said on the intervid, while Orith said, "Back where?" Ty, Liddy's support, moved towards her, as if to prevent her from activating the Nafal drive, but then hastily moved back to the Ansible to prevent Gaviter from getting access to it. He stopped, taken aback, and said, "Perhaps the Churton affected Ansible function?" "I'm checking it out," Ty said. "Why should it? Robot-operated Ansible transmission functioned in all the test flights." "Where are the AI reports?" Sean demanded. "I told you, there are none," Karth answered sharply. Orith was plugged in. Orith, still at the window, spoke without turning. Nothing happened. Sweet Today came over beside the Gathenian. Orith looked at her and said slowly, "Yes, Sweet Today, we cannot do this, I think." "I can't think." Sean had cleared a second window and stood looking out it. "Ugly," he said. "What is?" said Liddy. Gaviter said, as if reading from the Ecumenical Atlas, "Thick, stable atmosphere near the bottom of the temperature window for life. Microorganisms, bacterial clouds, bacterial reefs." "Germ stew," Sean said. "Lovely place to send us." "So that if we arrived as a neutron bomb or a black hole event, we'd only take bacteria with us," Ty said. "But we didn't." "Didn't what?" said Liddy. "Didn't arrive?" Karth asked. "Hey," Betton said, "is everybody going to stay on the bridge?" "I want to come there," said Riggs' little pipe, and then Aston's voice, clear but shaky, "Maba, I'd like to go back to Leiden now." "Come on," Karth said, and went to meet the children. Orith did not turn from the window, even when Aston came close and took Orith's hand. "What are you looking at, Maba?" "The planet, Aston." "What planet?" Orith looked at the child then. "There isn't anything," Aston said. "That brown color, that's the surface, the atmosphere of a planet." "There isn't any brown color. There isn't anything. I want to go back to Leiden. You said we could when we were done with the test." Orith looked around at last at the others. "Perception variation," Gaviter said. "I think," Ty said, "that we must establish that we are, that we got here, and then get here." "You mean go back," Betton said. "The readings are perfectly clear," Liddy said, holding on to the rim of her seat with both hands and speaking very distinctly. "Every coordinate in order. That's M60, etc. down there. What more do you want? Bacteria samples?" "Yes," Ty said. "Instrument function's been affected, so we can't rely on instrumental records." "Oh, shit's sake," said Liddy. "What a farce. All right, suit up, go down, get some goo, and then let's get out. Go home by Nafal." "By Nafal?" Sean and Ty echoed, and Gaviter said, "But we would spend 17 years V-time and no Ansible to explain why." "Why, Liddy?" Sweet Today asked. Liddy stared at the Hainish woman. "You want a Churton again?" she demanded, raucous. She looked round at them all. "Are you people made of stone?" Her face was ashy, crumpled, shrunken. "It doesn't bother you, seeing through the walls?" No one spoke, until Sean said cautiously, "How do you mean?" "I can see the stars through the walls." She stared round at them again, pointing at the carpet with its woven constellations. "You can't?" When no one answered, her jaw trembled in a little spasm, and she said, all right, I'm off duty. Sorry, be in my room." She stood up. "Maybe you should lock me in," she said. "Nonsense," said Sweet Today. "If I fall through, Liddy began and did not finish. She walked to the door, stiffly and cautiously, as if through a thick fog. She said something they did not understand. Cause, or perhaps gauze. Sweet Today followed her. I can see the stars, too, Rig announced. Hush, Karth said, putting an arm around the child. I can. I can see all the stars everywhere, and I can see V-Port, and I can see anything I want. Yes, of course, but hush now, the mother murmured, at which the child pulled free, stamped, and shrilled. I can too. I can see everything, and Aston can't, and there is a planet. There is too. No, don't hold me, don't, let me go. Grim, Karth carried the screaming child off to their quarters. Aston turned around to yell after Rig. This is not any planet. You're just making it up. Grim, Orth said, go to our room, please, Aston. Aston burst into tears and obeyed. Orth, with a glance of apology to the others, followed the short, weeping figure across the bridge and out into the corridor. The four remaining on the bridge stood silent. Canaries, Sean said. Hallucinations, Kavita proposed, subdued. An effect of the Chertin on extrasensitive organisms? Maybe. Ty nodded. Then is the Ansible not functioning, or are we hallucinating non-function? Sean asked after a pause. Gaviter went to the Ansible. This time Ty walked away from it, leaving it to him. I want to go down, she said. No reason not to, I suppose, Sean said unenthusiastically. Quat reason to? Gaviter asked over his shoulder. It's what we're here for, isn't it? It's what we volunteered to do, isn't it? To test instantaneous transilience, prove that it worked, that we are here. With the Ansible out, it'll be 17 years before V gets our radio signal. We can just churn back to V and tell them, Sean said. If we did that now, we'd have been here about 8 minutes. Tell them what? What kind of evidence is that? Anecdotal, said Sweet Today, who had come back quietly to the bridge. She moved like a big sailing ship, imposingly silent. Is Liddy all right? Sean asked. No, Sweet Today answered. She sat down where Liddy had sat at the Nuffall console. I ask a consensus about going down on planet, Ty said. I'll ask the others, Kavitar said and went out, returning presently with Karth. Go down, if you want, the Gathenian said. Orth's staying with the children for a bit. We are extremely disoriented. I will come down, Kavitar said. Can I come? Betten asked, almost in a whisper, not raising his eyes to any adult face. No, Ty said, as Gaviter said, yes. Betten looked at his mother, one quick glance. Why not? Gaviter asked her. We don't know the risks. The planet was surveyed by robot ships. We'll wear suits. Gaviter was honestly puzzled. I don't want the responsibility, Ty said through her teeth. Why is it yours? Gaviter asked, more puzzled still. We all share it. Betten is crew. I don't understand. I know you don't understand, Ty said, turned her back on them both, and went out. The man and the boy stood staring, Gaviter after Ty, Betten at the carpet. I'm sorry, Betten said. Not to be, Gaviter told him. What is going on? Sean asked in an over-controlled voice. Why are we keep crossing, we keep coming and going. Confusion due to the Chertin experience, Gaviter said. Sweet Today turned from the console. I have sent a distress signal, she said. I am unable to operate the Nuffall system. The radio, she cleared her throat. Radio function seems erratic. There was a pause. This is not happening, Sean said, or Orith said, but Orith had stayed with the children in another part of the ship, so it could not have been Orith who said, This is not happening. It must have been Sean. A chain of cause and effect is an easy thing to describe. A cessation of cause and effect is not. To those who live in time, sequency is the norm, the only model, and simultaneity seems a muddle, a mess, a hopeless confusion, and the description of that confusion hopelessly confusing. As the members of the crew network no longer perceived the network steadily and were unable to communicate their perceptions, an individual perception is the only clue to follow through the labyrinth of their dislocation. Gavita perceived himself as being on the bridge with Sean, Sweet Today, Betten, Karth, and Ty. He perceived himself as methodically checking out the ship's systems. The Nafal, he found dead, the radio functioning in erratic bursts, the internal electrical and mechanical systems of the ship all in order. He sent out a lander, unmanned, and brought it back, and perceived it as functioning normally. He perceived himself discussing with Ty her determination to go down on planet. Since he admitted his unwillingness to trust any instrumental reading on the ship, he had to admit her point that only material evidence would show that they had actually arrived at their destination, M60-340 Nolo. If they were going to have to spend the next 17 years traveling back to V in real time, it would be nice to have something to show for it, even if only a handful of slime. He perceived this discussion as perfectly rational. It was, however, interrupted by outbursts of egoizing not characteristic of the crew. If you're going, go, Sean said. Don't give me orders. Ty said. Somebody's got to stay in control here, Sean said. Not the men, Ty said. Not the Terrans, Karth said. Have you people no self-respect? Stress, Gavita said. Come on, Ty. Betten. All right, let's go. All right? In the lander, everything was clear to Gavita. One thing happened after another, just as it should. Lander operation is very simple, and he asked Betten to take them down. The boy did so. Ty sat, tense and compact as always, her strong fists clenched on her knees. Betten managed the little ship with aplomb, and sat back, tense also, but dignified. We're down, he said. No, we're not, Ty said. It says contact. Betten said, losing his assurance. An excellent landing, Gavita said. Never even felt it. He was running the usual tests. Everything was in order. Outside, the lander ports pressed a brownish darkness, a gloom. When Betten put on the outside lights, the atmosphere, like a dark fog, diffused the light into a useless glare. Tests all tally with survey reports, Gavita said. Will you go out, Ty, or use the servos? Out, she said. Out, Betten echoed. Gavita, assuming the formal crew role of support, which one of them would have assumed if he had been going out, assisted them to lock their helmets and decontaminate their suits. He opened the hatch series for them and watched them on the vid and from the port as they climbed down from the outer hatch. Betten went first. His slight figure, elongated by the whitish suit, was luminous in the weak glare of the lights. He walked a few steps from the ship, turned and waited. Ty was stepping off the ladder. She seemed to grow very short. Did she kneel down? Gavita looked from the port to the vidscreen and back. She was shrinking, sinking. she must be sinking into the surface, which could not be solid then, but bog or some suspension like quicksand. But Betton had walked on it and was walking back to her, two steps, three steps, on the ground, which Gewitter could not see clearly, but which must be solid and which must be holding Betton up because he was lighter. But no, Ty must have stepped into a hole, a trench of some kind, for he could see her only from the waist up now, her legs hidden in the dark bog or fog, but she was moving quickly, going right away from the lander and from Betton. "Bring them back," Sean said, and Gewitter said on the suit intercom, "Please return to the lander, Betton and Ty." Betton at once started up the ladder, then turned to look for his mother. A dim blotch that might be her helmet showed in the brown gloom, almost beyond the suffusion of light from the lander. "Please come in, Betton. Please return, Ty." The whitish suit flickered up the ladder, while Betton's voice in the intercom pleaded, "Ty, Ty, come back. Gewitter, should I go after her?" "No. Ty, please return at once to lander." The boy's crew integrity held. He came up into the lander and watched from the outer hatch, as Gewitter watched from the port. The vid had lost her. The pallid blotch sank into the formless murk. Gewitter perceived that the instruments recorded that the lander had sunk 3.2 meters since contact with planet's surface and was continuing to sink at an increasing rate. "What is the surface, Betton?"
"Like muddy ground. Where is she?"
"Please return at once, Ty. Please return to Shobi, Lander One and all crew," said the ship intercom. It was Ty's voice. "This is Ty," it said. "Please return at once to ship, lander and all crew."
"Stay in suit, in decon, please, Betton," Gewitter said. "I'm sealing the hatch."
"But all right," said the boy's voice. Gewitter took the lander up, decontaminating it, and Betton's suit on the way. He perceived that Betton and Sean came with him through the hatch series into the Shobi and along the halls to the bridge, and that Karth, Sweet Today, Sean, and Ty were on the bridge. Betton ran to his mother and stopped. He did not put out his hands to her. His face was immobile, as if made of wax or wood.
"Were you frightened?" she asked. "What happened down there?"
And she looked to Gewitter for an explanation. Gewitter perceived nothing. Unduring a non-period of no long, he perceived nothing was, had happening, happened, that had not happened. Lost, he groped. Lost, he found the word that saved. "You," he said, his tongue thick, dumb. "You called us." It seemed that she denied, but it did not matter. What mattered? Sean was talking. Sean could tell.
"Nobody called, Gewitter," he said. "You and Betton went out. I was support. When I realized I couldn't get the lander stable, that there's something funny about that surface, I called you back into the lander and we came up."
All Gewitter could say was, "Insubstantial."
"But Ty came," Betton began and stopped. Gewitter perceived that the boy moved away from his mother's denying touch. What mattered?
"Nobody went down," Sweet Today said. After a silence and before it, she said, "There is no down to go to." Gewitter tried to find another word, but there was none. He perceived, outside the main port, a brownish, murky convexity, through which, as he looked intently, he saw small stars shining. He found a word then, the wrong word. "Lost," he said. And speaking, perceived how the ship's lights dimmed slowly into a brownish murk,
faded, darkened, were gone, while all the soft hum and busyness of the ship's systems died away into the real silence that was always there. But there was nothing there. Nothing had happened. We are at V-port, he tried with all his will to say, but there was no saying. The suns burn through my flesh, Liddy said. I am the suns, said Sweet Today. Not I, all is. Don't breathe, cried Orith. It is death, Sean said. What I feared is nothing. Nothing, they said. Unbreathing, the ghosts flitted, shifted in the ghost shell of a cold, dark hull, floating near a world of brown fog, an unreal planet. They spoke, but there were no voices. There is no sound in vacuum, nor in non-time. In her cabined solitude, Liddy felt the gravity lighten to the half-g of the ship's core mass. She saw them, the nearer and the farther suns, burn through the dark gauze of the walls and hulls and the bedding and her body. The brightest, the sun of this system, floated directly under her navel. She did not know its name. I am the darkness between the suns, one said. I am nothing, one said. I am you, one said. You, one said, you, and breathed and reached out and spoke, listen, crying out to the other, to the others, listen. We have always known this. This is where we have always been, will always be, at the hearth, at the center. There is nothing to be afraid of, after all. I can't breathe, one said. I am not breathing, one said. There is nothing to breathe, one said. You are breathing. Please breathe, said another. We're here at the hearth, said another. Orith had laid the fire. Karth lit it. As it caught, they both said softly in Karhidish, praise also the light and creation unfinished. The fire caught with spark spits, crackles, sudden flares. It did not go out. It burned. The others groped round. They were nowhere, but they were nowhere together. The ship was dead, but they were in the ship. A dead ship cools off fairly quickly, but not immediately. Close the doors, come in by the fire, keep the cold night out before we go to bed. Karth went with Rig to persuade Liddy from her starry vault. The navigator would not get up. It's my fault, she said. Don't egoize, Karth said mildly. How could it be? I don't know. I want to stay here, Liddy muttered. Then Karth begged her. Oh, Liddy, not alone. How else? The old woman asked coldly. But she was ashamed of herself then, and ashamed of her guilt trip, and growled, oh, all right. She heaved herself up and wrapped a blanket around her body and followed Karth and Rig. The child carried a little bio-loom. It glowed in the black corridors, just as the plants of the aerobic tanks lived on, metabolizing, making an air to breathe, for a while. The light moved before her, like a star among the stars, through darkness to the room full of books, where the fire burned in the stone hearth. Hello, children, Liddy said. What are we doing here? Telling stories, Sweet Today replied. Sean had a little voice recorder notebook in his hand. Does it work? Liddy inquired. Seems to. We thought we'd tell... What happened, Sean said, squinting the narrow black eyes in his narrow black face at the firelight. Each of us, what it seemed like, seems like to us, so that, as a record, yes, in case, How funny that it works, though, your notebook, when nothing else does. It's voice-activated, Sean said absently. So, go on, Gavitor. Gavitor finished telling his version of the expedition to the planet's surface. We didn't even bring back samples, he ended. I never thought of them. Sean went with you, not me, Ty said. You did go, and I did, the boy said, with a certainty that stopped her. And we did go outside, and Sean and Gavitor were support in the lander, and I took samples. They're in the stasis closet. I don't know if Sean was in the lander or not, Gavitor said, rubbing his forehead painfully. Where would the lander have gone? Sean said. Nothing is out there. We're nowhere outside time, is all I can think. But when one of you tells how they saw it, it seems as if it was that way. But then the next one changes the story, and I... Orith shivered, drawing closer to the fire. I never believed this damn thing would work, said Liddy, bear-like in the dark cave of her blanket. Not understanding it was the trouble, Karth said. None of us understood how it would work, not even Gavitor. Isn't that true? Yes, Gavitor said. So that if our psychic interaction with it affected the process, or is the process, said Sweet Today, so far as we're concerned. Do you mean, Liddy said in a tone of deep existential disgust, that we have to believe in it to make it work? You have to believe in yourself in order to act, don't you? Ty said. No, the navigator said. Absolutely not. I don't believe in myself. I know some things, enough to go on. An analogy, Gavitor offered. The effective action of a crew depends on the members perceiving themselves as a crew. You could call it believing in the crew or just being it, right? So maybe, to Churton, we conscious ones, maybe it depends on our consciously perceiving ourselves as transilient, as being in the other place. The destination? We lost our crewness, certainly. Are there wiles? Karth said. We fell apart. We lost the thread, Sean said. Lost, Orith said, meditatively, laying another massive, half-weightless log on the fire, volleying sparks up into the chimney, slow stars. We lost what? Sweet Today asked. No one answered for a while. When I can see the sun through the carpet, Liddy said. So can I, Betton said, very low. I can see V-port, said Rig, and everything. I can tell you what I can see. I can see Leiden if I look, and my room on the One Blin, and... First, Rig, said Sweet Today, tell us what happened. All right, Rig said agreeably. Hold on to me harder, Maba. I start floating. Well, we went to the library, me and Aston and Betton was Elder Sib, and the adults were on the bridge, and I was going to go to sleep like I do when we Naffle fly, but before I even lay down, there was the brown planet and V-port and both the suns and everywhere else, and you could see through everything, but Aston couldn't, but I can. We never went anywhere, Aston said. Rig tells stories all the time. We all tell stories all the time, Aston, Carr said. Not dumb ones like Rig's. Even dumber, said Orus. What we need is to know, Sean said, what transilience is, and we don't, because we never did it before. Nobody ever did it before. Not in the flesh, said Liddy. We need to know what's real, what happened, whether anything happened. Tai gestured at the cave of firelight around them and the dark beyond it. Where are we? Are we here? Where is here? What's the story?
We have to tell it, Sweet Today said. Recount it, relate it, like Rig.
Aston, how does a story begin?
1,000 winters ago, 1,000 miles away, the child said, and Sean murmured, Once upon a time,
there was a ship called the Shobi, said Sweet Today, on a test flight, trying out the Churton with a crew of 10. Their names were Rig, Aston, Betten, Karth, Orith, Liddy, Tai, Sean, Gaviter, and Sweet Today. And they related their story, each one and together. There was silence, the silence that was always there, except for the stir and crackle of the fire and the small sounds of their breathing, their movements, until one of them spoke at last, telling the story.
The boy and his mother, said the light, pure voice, were the first human beings ever to set foot on that world. Again the silence, and again a voice. Although she wished, she realized that she really hoped the thing wouldn't work because it would make her skills, her whole life, obsolete. All the same, she really wanted to learn how to use it, too, if she could, if she wasn't too old to learn. A long, softly throbbing pause, and another voice. They went from world to world, and each time they lost the world they left, lost it in time dilation, their friends getting old and dying while they were in Nuffle flight. If there were a way to live in one's own time and yet move among the worlds, they wanted to try it. Staking everything on it. The next voice took up the story, because nothing works except what we give our souls to. Nothing's safe except what we put at risk. A while, a little while, and a voice. It was like a game. It was like we were still in the Shobi at V-Port, just waiting before we went into Nuffal flight. But it was like we were at the brown planet, too, at the same time. And one of them was just pretend, and the other one wasn't, but I didn't know which. So it was like when you pretend in a game, but I didn't want to play. I didn't know how. Another voice. If the Churton principle were proved to be applicable to actual transilience of living, conscious beings, it would be a great event in the mind of his people, for all people. A new understanding, a new partnership, a new way of being in the universe, a wider freedom. He wanted that very much. He wanted to be one of the crew that first formed that partnership, the first people to be able to think this thought, and to relate it. But also, he was afraid of it. Maybe it wasn't a true relation, maybe false, maybe only a dream. He didn't know. It was not so cold, so dark at their backs as they sat round the fire. Was it the waves of Leiden hushing on the sand? Another voice. She thought a lot about her people, too, about guilt and expiation and sacrifice. She wanted a lot to be on this flight that might give people more freedom. But it was different from what she thought it would be. What happened wasn't what mattered. What mattered was that she came to be with people who gave her freedom without guilt. She wanted to stay with them, to be crew with them, and with her son, who was the first human being to set foot on an unknown world. A long silence, but not deep. Only as deep as the soft drum of the ship's systems, steady and unconscious as the circulation of the blood. Another voice. They were thoughts in the mind. What else had they ever been?
so they could be in V and at the brown planet, and desiring flesh and entire spirit and illusion and reality all at once, as they'd always been. When he remembered this, his confusion and fear ceased, for he knew that they couldn't be lost. They got lost, but they found the way, said another voice, soft above the hum and hushing of the ship's systems, in the warm, fresh air and light inside the solid walls and hulls. Only 9 voices had spoken, and they looked for the 10th. But the 10th had gone to sleep, thumb in mouth. That story was told and is yet to be told, the mother said. Go on, I'll churton here with Rig. They left those 2 by the fire and went to the bridge, and then to the hatches, to invite on board a crowd of anxious scientists, engineers, and officials of V-Port and the Acumen, whose instruments had been assuring them that the Shobi had vanished 44 minutes ago into non-existence, into silence. What happened? They asked. What happened? And the Shobis looked at one another and said, Well, it's quite a story.